I didn't know what a quarry was until I saw the one that would belong to us. A pit carved for mining. Dig what you need, the dynamite gap, leave a hole for evidence. Don't think about air filling it up. Air fills up everything. Water makes the quarry more than it is, the blue we were drawn to. On the dock, looking out, my mother on one side, my father the other, their big shoulders pressing me in. It was our first summer living beside a lake that wasn't a lake, with wind tents of blue moving in the jeweled sunlight, up and gone and up again. The limestone cut into jagged rock, layered with the weight of dead animals, ancient sea animals, imprints. Lush green trees they surrounded as a forest. Dad had found the place by chance after spotting the for sale sign outside a white gate that led to a long gravel driveway, a bend that led to a mini lake, the house of Mum's dreams. We made up dives that summer, me and Cindy. The watermelon dive, legs in a V. The about-to-die dive, a rambling, dramatic shotgun death off the dock. The scissor kick dive, a flutter of pointed legs in the air. And the drowning dive, rise to the surface and float like the dead fish that smacked against the limestone rock, oozing decay's stink. With a 2-year advantage, I gave my 9-year-old cousin a 3-second head start whenever we raced off the dock to reach the floating raft. Sometimes a hit of the giggles cut through my determination, a memory of something we'd laughed about while lying in the dark, tucked in single beds, or while eating Rice Krispies, opening up our food-filled mouths to shout, "Seafood diet!" Mom served as judge as she sat on the dock, smoking her brand, Benson and Hedges. She was there to rescue us if we were to drown. I knew this was an illusion. Though an athlete, Mom could barely swim, and deep water scared her. She excelled at land games, sports with rackets like badminton and tennis, especially tennis. Our shelves of knickknacks were stacked with gold trophies, tiny females frozen in mid-serve. "Watch, Mom, watch!" "Caitlin Maharg, I'm always watching." I dove, and then Cindy dove, and we made her grade us. 10 out of 10, said Mom. "Me or Cindy?" "Both." She lit another cigarette and exhaled the burst of smoke. "Aw, Mom, someone has to win." Despite her fierce competitiveness on the tennis court and my constant pleading, she refused to budge. We always came out even. When we got tired of diving, we swam like the darting sunfish, the smallest fish in the quarry. Standing on tubes was something Cindy could do better than me. Her smaller build gave her an advantage. I could stand on an inner tube no problem, but my balance wouldn't last like hers. My long legs wobbled like the egg-shaped weebles we played with on the floor of Cindy's Burlington bedroom when we weren't spying on her 2 older brothers. My Uncle Jim's new job had brought the Brandt family back to Ontario, all the way from Calgary. Because they'd been so far away, I'd never thought of them as family, until now. Dad didn't like to swim. When he did go in the water, to work the stress off himself or shampoo his gray peppered hair, he stayed within arm's reach of the dock ladder. Because his arm was so long, like all of his limbs, he looked farther away than he really was. When the water was still, you could see rock bottom. But you couldn't touch it, not off the dock. Feet had no resting place. On clear, windless days, we watched the carp suspended below, like sunken logs or torpedoes. They never did anything. In fact, it was us that scared them, our manic splashes getting in and out of the water, our specialized dives. After the water settled again, Cindy and I would try to find them, but they'd long disappeared.
Welcome back to The County Writes, The County Reads. I'm Lynn Pickering, and that was Catherine Graham reading from the first chapter of her novel, Quarry. So, Catherine, you're wondering why I asked you to read that part, right?
Yes.
Because I wrote to say that that really jumped out at me for three reasons. One, our property here in the county is right beside a quarry.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You mentioned Grimsby.
Mm-hmm.
My mother's best friend, who used to visit us all the time when we were kids, was the housekeeper for the Betzner family, who owned the hardware store in Grimsby, you know, many decades ago.
Right.
And the father in the story grew up in Baie des Fées, Quebec, which we used to visit all the time when we lived in Beaconsfield.
Oh, wow. We'll have to talk after the show, Lynn.
So I just start your book, and then all these things are jumping out at me.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, so that
lovely.
Was fun. So explain the importance of the quarry and the different meanings that I know you describe.
Well, I mean, this is where the story, Caitlin's story and my story kind of merge, because I did grow up beside a water-filled limestone quarry with my parents, and I just love, again, I'm drawn to images, and the quarry, I didn't know it would be such a force for my creative journey, but it really is the core, and quarry also comes from the word cur, as in heart, and the core of who we are is the heart, I believe, and a quarry is also a man-made landscape. It's blasted into being, much like grief blasts us, and we are never the same after. And what happens with that hole? What do we fill it with? What is filled in it, whether we like it or not? So it really works so many things that I can think about with the creative process, with Caitlin's journey, with my own journey. And then there's all the details. If you look closely, you see the fossils, which are fascinating, and all the time that took to make these things last. And they are also a different way of language. And Caitlin at one point talks about brailing the language of stone through touch. So it's and if you've ever swam in a quarry, then you'll know too how soft the water is because of the limestone. So and then of course the beauty as it changes through the seasons, from the reflection of the fall trees going into it, the oranges and the reds versus the frozen sort of, it's just completely dormant, but yet at the same time all the things are still there underneath, and then the cracking that happens, the black ice with spring.
Now, this is a novel, but I just explain the parallels to your life, because as you said earlier, your parents died when you were sort of late teens, early 20s, and Caitlin's mother is ill with cancer for many years, and she dies when Caitlin is 19.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pretty close?
Pretty much the same. Yeah, I mean, that was the strange thing. There's such a strange period of adolescence. I think we all have sort of our bizarre stories of how we kind of handle it and go through it, and it's really like a time of metamorphosis. Like, I think about the stages of a butterfly before it becomes a butterfly. You're in this pupa and something that crawls and can become something that flies, and adolescence, I think, is a lot. They feel awkward and gangly, and you're leaving childhood, and maybe you don't want to leave childhood, but there's no turning back, and then you're forced into things, and then your mind and your body aren't necessarily synchronized yet. So it's an interesting time for a writer to also explore, because a lot of firsts, of course, come up: first love, first job, and those are awkward and funny, and often be, you know, humorous things to write about as well, which is a sort of a way to also complement the grief, or almost like look at life just not from the one angle of grief, because there's a lot of humor in life as well too.
Caitlin also goes to McMaster?
She does.
You went to McMaster?
Wow, what a shock that is.
Caitlin works at Niagara Falls, which I found another interesting thing, because it's water. The water is very important.
Very. Yeah.
Did you work at Niagara Falls?
I did. I sold bus tours.
Okay, so is this a biography?
No, it's interesting. Because, you know, people said, why don't you write a memoir? And it didn't want to be that. And in fact, so I couldn't, there's an emotional truth that runs through that Caitlin and I share. And yes, there's some physical details, but her story became something else. And the truth of it, too, needed to be what the truth of Quarry needed to be. So for that reason, it just couldn't be a memoir. And I think, too, because I'm a poet at heart, I also find that the imagination really guides how the poem needs to be. So it might start with, say, for instance, that orchid image that came, but then it becomes something else in the writing, and that's the same sort of way. So in a way, Corey, it's very narrative, it's in dialogue and all the things that you have in fiction, but it's also, to me, also in a way like a long poem with a narrative bone to it.
Okay. Now, Caitlin's grandmother comes to help with her mother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, being a grandmother myself, I found that this grandmother was not very grandmotherly at all.
Well, I'm glad you think so, because Caitlin doesn't think she's very nice either.
No.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing as well. We assume grandmother, we think, oh, lovely to be grandmother, and all grandmothers are lovely, and they're, you know, like people. There's a whole range. Yeah.
Of course, you know when you're reading the book, the time in which it's set, because there's a lot of the music, and we're going to talk about that as well, but her dad listens to As It Happens with Barbara Frum.
Yes, yes. Well, this was one of the lovely sort of coming around moments, because when we launched last June, I'm honored to say that Mary Lou Finley is a personal friend, and of course she was the host of As It Happens for many years as well, too. And my publisher thought, well, let's do like an interview, not just reading at the launch, but you do an interview. And who might we ask? And I just thought, well, maybe Mary Lou. And she just said yes right away, and that she would love to do it. So, again, it was like this sort of art and life merging. I mean, there CBC is mentioned with As It Happens, and here's Mary Lou. And those are the parts, I guess, too, that are quite poignant for me, because I think, gosh, my dad really loved this moment right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At one point, you write also about, I guess, the beginnings of an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me about that part.
Well, I think, too, it's going back. When we were talking a bit about the mother and the daughter and how the mother, she's dealing with cancer. And it was a time, too, when people weren't talking about things. I think parents thought it's best not to tell children things as a way of protecting them. But I think we know now that that can backfire. And then you're sort of seeing things.
You don't explain sex to them, yeah. Otherwise they'll have
exactly,
sex.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And then, whoa, why is my stomach growing? What's happening? So I think for Caitlin, part of her psychology too, I mean, with sort of illness and so on, and when secrets hold a lot of power and they have a lot of energy, and that energy, when it's dormant, goes somewhere. And Caitlin's a very intuitive person, and she doesn't understand the power of intuition at this point yet, all the sort of signals that she receives, and with that also comes some guilt. And I think she just takes on guilt too of other people, including the grandmother or the father's difficulties and so on. And where does that energy go? And it just stays within her. So she, I think that also is part of the eating disorder, of having some kind of control over something. Because if you can't control other things going around you, try and then, say, control what you're putting into your body. And then also the strangeness of your body kind of growing into adulthood, which is a healthy thing. Whereas the mother is going into the rapid sort of opposite direction, not a natural aging, but from healthy tennis player to bedridden, bed sores, can't walk, to coma, to the end. So it was that acceleration as well, that they were going in opposite trajectories, and how that affected Caitlin's psychology. But she, of course, didn't know that, because she's just trying to live her life.
Mm-hmm. And deal with what's happening.
Yes. Yes.
There are so many musical references in the book, as I said, and so the parent song is Disguise in Love with You. They're also referred to Love Will Keep Us Together, Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree. There's many others. And I always ask authors to select music they'd like to hear.
Oh, wow.
So what would you like to play?
Oh, This Guy's in Love with You. That
all
would
right.
be fabulous. And actually, speaking of the music, we had some help with the launch, and Andrew Arntfield, who suggested too, like, why don't we have like a soundtrack of all of the music? So we had that playing in the background. All the songs that you mentioned, plus the other songs that are in there as well, during the launch were played. So it was really, even some of the Partridge Family, and was great.
All right, well, it's been terrific talking to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Lynn. Thanks.
All right, here's This Guy's in Love with You.
You see this guy was in love with you. Yes, I'm in love. Who looks at you the way I do? When you smile, I can't tell. We know each other very well. How can I show you? I'm glad I got to know you, 'cause I've heard some talk. They say you think I'm fine. Yes, I'm in love. And what I do to make you mine, tell me now. Is it so? Don't let me be the last to know. My hands are shaking, let my heart break, 'cause I need your love. I want your love.
That's Herb Alpert and This Guy's in Love with You. Catherine Graham's book, The Celery Forest, is published by Buck Rider Books. Quarry is published by Two Wolves Press. Up next, recently Linwood Barclay won an award for his first novel for young adults. You'll hear an excerpt from my conversation with him from last year. Stay with 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county.
Tell me now, is it so? Don't let me. My hands are shaking, let my heart keep breaking, 'cause I need your love. I want your love. Stay not, I'll just die.